This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Everything in Israel came to a halt for 2 minutes today, as Israelis paid silent tribute to Yitzhak Rabin. About 4,500 mourners attended the Israeli Prime Minister's funeral today, including President Clinton, King Hussein of Jordan, and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. In 1993, Rabin signed an agreement with PLO leader Yasser Arafat. Rabin's willingness to trade land for peace earned him a Nobel Peace Prize and cost him his life. The Jewish law student who confessed to the assassination said he was justified because Rabin was giving back land to the enemies. The paradox, of course, is that the land in question was taken by the Israelis in 1967 when Rabin was the head of the military. Earlier today, we called Israel and spoke with Zev Chaifetz. He was the director of the government press office under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Now he's a columnist for the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. I asked him if there was a moment of the funeral that particularly moved him.
Well, I think that most of us were moved, most Israelis were most moved by King Hussein. First of all, the very fact of his coming to Jerusalem, which he hasn't done since he was a boy, at least not publicly. The fact that he was willing to appear at such a funeral and the things that he said. He called Rabin his brother, and he compared his assassination to the assassination of his own grandfather. That's very, very emotional stuff for Israelis. So in a sense, I don't want to say that King Hussein stole the show at Rabin's funeral, but we've all seen funerals before. And this, even state funerals, and this was a unique moment.
What else really got to you?
Well, look, Yitzhak Rabin was a very, very widely respected guy. He was not a widely loved one. And the reaction to his death, to his murder, is one part shock that such a thing could have happened, and one part, you know, fury at the man who did it, and one part fear over what's going to come next. But I wouldn't say that there has been a huge outpouring of emotion regarding Rabin himself, Rabin the man, simply because he didn't evince that kind of emotion. He didn't arouse that kind of emotion in most people.
How did you first find out that Rabin had been assassinated? Were you watching it on TV?
I was at home watching the Notre Dame Navy football game on live on television. And a friend of mine called and said, "Hey, Rabin has been shot." And, you know, interestingly, it never occurred to me that he was shot by an Arab. I was sure, the second he told me, I was sure that it must have been some kind of a Jewish fanatic.
Why were you so sure?
I don't know. I guess because we've seen it coming. There have been threats to Rabin's life by these Jewish fanatics over the past few months. Some of them were made publicly. Rabin himself discussed these threats several times on television in the last few weeks before his death. Even the rally that he spoke at was called a rally in favor of peace and against violence. And so we were aware of the fact that the rising tide of violence was coming from Jewish religious fanatics. And so interestingly enough, it simply didn't occur to me until much, much later that it even might have been an Arab. I just knew it must have been one of these Jewish guys.
Let me ask you, I'm not sure quite how to phrase this, but when you found out that Rabin was assassinated, were you at all relieved almost to find out that it was a Jew and not an Arab?
Well, you know, that's a funny question, because a generation ago when John Kennedy was assassinated, many, many American Jews' first thought was, "I hope that the assassin isn't a Jew." And this time when Rabin was assassinated, I think many Jews' first thought was, "I hope the assassin is a Jew, because if he's an Arab, it will complicate the peace process, whereas if he's just a Jew, it's all in the family." I didn't have that particular reaction, and I must say that for me, at least, it's much worse that he's a Jew than if he were an Arab.
Explain why.
Well, because we're accustomed to Arabs being our enemy, and we know how to you know, we know how to get mad, and we know how to react, and we know how to respond, and we know how to where to put this kind of anger. Of course, no Arab terrorist has ever killed an Israeli prime minister, but there have been a number of outrageous actions carried out over the years by Arab terrorists, and we know how to deal with that. This sort of an action by a Jew is something entirely different. It's a new threat. It's a new challenge. It's something we don't know where to put or how to deal with. And it, like all new things, it's frightening. We're going to have to learn as a society. First of all, we're going to have to find the determination as a society to confront Jewish fundamentalism, which we haven't had until now. And then we're going to have to find the willingness to confront it in ways that will be effective.
What impact do you think this is going to have on the Israeli public and on the Israeli government when it comes to dealing with zealots within Israel, Jewish zealots?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, up until now, the Israeli political parties have flirted with the Orthodox parties, who in turn are in bed with the zealots in many cases. And so while the secular mainstream politicians haven't liked these zealots, and Rabin has liked them least of all, in fact, in his book, in his memoirs, he referred to them as a cancer on the body of Israel, neither of the parties, the Likud nor the Labor Party, have been willing to get into an all-out confrontation with them because they have lots of voters. And I must say that in the last couple of years, since the signing of the Oslo peace accord with the Palestinians, or the Oslo understandings, the Likud especially, led by Bibi Netanyahu, has gotten into bed with the fundamentalists in a very intimate way. Netanyahu and other Likud leaders appear at fundamentalist functions and appear with fundamentalist leaders, and have, in other ways, sought an alliance with them. So the first question is whether the Israeli politicians, and especially the politicians on the secular nationalist right, that is to say the Likud, will now say that these terrorists, these fundamentalists, Jewish terrorists and fundamentalists who advocate the violent overthrow of the State of Israel and who deny the legitimacy of the democratically elected government here, are, for them, beyond the pale. If they are able to say such a thing, if they have the courage to do it, then I think that Israeli society as a whole will find the courage to isolate these fundamentalists and to call them what they are, to call them thugs and murderers and terrorists. If, on the other hand, they continue to, the Likud continues to do business with these people, then it's going to be much harder to isolate them.
How much do you know now about the killer? Do you know yet whether he's associated with a larger group?
We don't know. We know that he's the boy next door. He's a 27-year-old law student. He comes from a well-known and well-respected family in a suburb of Tel Aviv. He has a religious education, a national religious education. We know that whether or not he actually is a card-carrying member of any underground organization, he certainly shares the beliefs of the underground organization.
What are some of the beliefs of the Jewish extremist groups in Israel now? What do they want?
Well, they want, in the end of the day, they want to turn this country into a theocracy. They want the rule of the Torah rather than the rule of law. They want the rule of rabbis rather than the rule of the majority. They also want all of the territory of the West Bank, which they view as part of the God's patrimony to the Jewish people. So that's what they want. They want for Israel what the Iranian fundamentalists want for Iran. They want a society which will move backwards 500 or 1,000 years into a pre-modern, pre-democratic, pre-industrial period in which the word of God is law.
Is most of the far right in Israel a religious far right? You said that most of the people, you know, that a lot of the religious zealots would like to turn Israel into a theocracy. Is that true of the Israeli right in general?
No, that's a very good question. The Israeli right is composed of two kinds of rightists. Some are secular Israelis who are hawks. They believe that for reasons of security or for reasons of the economy or for whatever normal reasons that one might have, Israel would be foolish to relinquish territory in the West Bank or in Gaza or that sort of thing. Those are people who are hawkish in a way that, let's say, Ronald Reagan was a hawk in American terms during the Cold War. But along with them, and really the dominant strain now on the Israeli right, are the religious fundamentalist right-wingers who don't care about Israel's security as such and who don't care about the economy as such. What they care about is God's promise to the Jewish people regarding the West Bank and Gaza. So that no matter what security arrangements are made, no matter what economic arrangements are made, they're not interested and they could never be satisfied. And so that's really the distinction. I think that the chairman of the Jewish Agency, Avram Burg, who himself is religious, said, and I absolutely agree with it, that this was not a political murder. This was a religious murder. He was murdered, Rabin was murdered, not because this assassin disagreed with his politics, but because he disagreed with his theology.
There's an expression that a lot of Jews use, and it's almost become a little like in joke, actually. Is it good for the Jews? So if something happens, you know, is it good for the Jews? The fact that a Jewish extremist assassinated the Israeli prime minister, it's like that it obliterates that whole concept that something is either good or bad for the Jews, that the Jews are this kind of monolithic group. When a Jew hurts a Jew like that, when a Jew assassinates the head of state.
No, I agree. I think that it's very clear to us now that that we may be called Jews and these fundamentalists may be called Jews, but we're not the same thing. We don't belong to the same tribe. We don't belong to the same people. We don't have the same interests. If they're Jews, then I'm not one. And if I am a Jew, then they're not.
My guest is Zev Chaifetz. He's joining us on the phone from Israel, and he is a columnist for the Jerusalem Report. He was the director of the government press office during the Begin administration. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Zev Chaifetz on the phone from Israel. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Report. What do you think the impact of his death will be on the peace process?
Paris is likely to get, in the short term, the kind of public opinion rally around the flag support that Lyndon Johnson, say, got after the assassination of JFK. But the problem is that once that moment is passed and people start to deal with Paris as Paris, he has a track record, a political track record in Israel as being unelectable. He was the Labor Party candidate in 77 and again in 81, and he lost both times, and again in 84 when he tied and everyone thought he should have won. And so, Paris is not a good candidate. And he will also be 73 or 74 by the time of the next election. It means he's not a young man. And so I don't know. It's hard to predict what, the longer-term effect will be. Certainly, he does not enjoy the credibility with the Israeli public on issues of security that Rabin had, which means that there is not the inclination to trust his judgment sight unseen the way there has been for many Israelis with Yitzhak Rabin.
Peres doesn't have that military background.
Shimon Peres never served in the army. He was he has a long career as a defense technocrat, starting from the 1948 war and including service as Minister of Defense. But the problem with Peres is less his lack of a military background and the perception that he tends to be very Pollyanna-ish in his views of the world. One good example was that he opposed Menachem Begin's decision to bomb the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981 because he claimed that then-French President Mitterrand had given him a promise that the French would discontinue support to the Iraqi nuclear program. And I think that most Israelis and actually most people around the world thought of that as typically rose-colored. And sometimes it can be dangerously rose, rose-colored, in the opinion of many.
Peres and Rabin were longtime rivals. They fought over leadership of the party. Had they made up in the past few years?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's I'm sure that up until a few years ago, Rabin would have turned over in his grave at the thought of being eulogized by Peres, whom he hated, and he wrote a book which was largely devoted to sliming Peres. But in the last few years, once they started to serve in this government, Rabin is prime minister, Peres is foreign minister, they seem to, without ever really saying anything about it in public, make up with one another and to work very harmoniously with one another. And today, Peres called Rabin my older brother in the eulogy which he gave. I think that it's fair to say that that in the last 3 years, their work together on the peace process especially brought them together.
What do you think that Rabin did in the peace process that's going to be particularly hard for anybody else to do as well?
Rabin was able in the peace process to convince at least a large segment of the Israeli public that when he said that a concession was safe to make, that it was indeed safe to make. Because he enjoyed the kind of authority that his honesty, his lifelong honesty, and his lifelong expertise in security matters conveyed. And there's no one else. There are others who have great authority, say Ehud Barak, the former chief of staff, who's now Minister of Interior. He has great authority, but not a long public record, whereas Peres has a long public record, but not great authority. And so it will be very hard for them to replace Rabin in that regard.
What was Rabin's strategy for changing Israeli popular opinion and trying to move it toward peace?
Well, Rabin was very bad at changing Israeli public opinion. Rabin's strongest card in terms of public relations was also his weakest one. That is to say, he was a very poor speaker. He was very plain-spoken. He was very uncharming. He never tried to be charming. He was blunt, and he acted as though, because he saw what should happen, that others would naturally see what should happen with time. Now, that, in one way, instilled a lot of confidence in people regarding Rabin, because they saw him as this very honest, very direct, very blunt guy. Nobody thought that Rabin was lying to them. On the other hand, he never really eloquently made the case in Israel for his policies. And so he didn't, in that sense, in the Churchillian sense, or in the, Reagan-esque sense, he didn't sway public opinion through his mastery of the media or of communication.
Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the head of the Likud party, the opposition party, has said that no assassin's bullet will change the government. Are you convinced that Likud won't try to challenge labor and to have a change of government?
Well, it was a nice thing for Netanyahu to say. On the other hand, there's no doubt that Peres had 61 votes, which is a majority. So with or without Netanyahu's permission, there was no way that he wasn't going to form the next government. But Netanyahu has already said, and I think it's legitimate, that once Peres forms the next government, the Likud, as the opposition party, will get back to the business of trying to topple it and to force new elections.
Do you think that the assassination is going to move public opinion in Israel closer to or further away from peace?
In the short term, I think the assassination will move some people closer to peace, or at least put the anti-peace forces on the defensive. In the longer term, though, I don't think it's going to have a great effect. I think that peace is going to have to make its own case, and people will judge it on its merits, because peace is too critical an issue for public sentiment alone to sway it.
Is there going to be a national period of mourning in Israel?
Yes, there'll be 2 days of mourning, and then really the first week after the assassination will be an informal period of mourning.
And that's supposed to be, at least the initial couple of days, is supposed to be a period where politics goes into mourning, too. Is that really going to happen?
Not a chance.
Politics is put on hold?
No, not a chance. Uh-huh. Rabin, on the night that he was shot, there were already people discussing politics on television and in the press. This is a political country, and no matter what the etiquette of it is, people are going to be thinking about and talking about politics.
Zev Chaifetz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Zev Chaifetz was the director of the government press office under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Now he's a columnist for the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He's also a novelist. His latest novel is called The Bookmakers. Chaifetz spoke with us today from his home in Tel Aviv. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.